Reading from Startide Rising by David Brin, Chapter 86, Toshio. Toshio finished the rewiring, slapped the cover over the transmitter on Thomas Orley's sled, and spread a light smear of mud on the plate to make it seem long unopened. Then he unhitched the monofilament line from the unit, tied a small red marker ribbon to the end, and let the almost invisible fiber drift down into the depths. Now he was out of touch with Streaker. It made him feel more alone than ever, even lonelier than when Denny and Sahat had departed early in the morning. He hoped Takata Jim would follow orders and wait here until Streaker left. If he did, Jillian would call down as they blasted away and warn him of the modifications that had been made to the longboat and this transmitter. But what if Takata Jim were, indeed, a traitor? What if he took off early? Charles Dart would probably be aboard then, as well as Ignacio Metz, 3 Stenos, and perhaps 3 or 4 Kikwi. Toshio wished none of them harm. It was an agonizing choice. He looked up and saw Charles Dart happily muttering to himself as he played with his new robot. Toshio shook his head, glad that the chimp, at least, was happy. He slid into the water and swam over to his own sled. He had jettisoned its tiny radio an hour ago. He strapped himself in and turned on the motors. He still had to make one more splice below the island. The old robot, the damaged probe Charles Dart had abandoned down near the bottom of the drill tree shaft, had one last customer. Kredaki, hanging around Streaker's old site, still wanted to talk to Sahat's voices. Toshio figured he owed the captain the favor, even if it did feel like he was humoring a delusion. As the sled sank, Toshio thought about the rest of his job here, the things he might have to do before he could leave. "Let Tom Orley be waiting for me when I come back up," he wished fervently. "That would solve everything. Let Mr. Orley be finished with his job up in the north and land up there while I'm below." Toshio smiled ironically. "And while you're at it, Ifni, why not throw in a giant fleet of good guys to clear the skies of baddies, He descended down the narrow shaft into the gloom. Chapter 87, Jillian.
Drat! Triple hell! The line's dead. Toshio's already cut it.
"Don't be overly alarmed," the Nis spoke reassuringly. "It is quite likely that Takata Jim confiscated all of the bombs. Did not Midshipman Iwashika report that he saw several being dismantled for fuel, as you expected?"
"Yes, and I told him not to worry about it, but it never occurred to me to ask him to count them. I was caught up in the minutiae of moving the ship, and I didn't think Charlie would do any real harm, even if by some chance he managed to keep one."
"Now, of course, we know better." Jillian looked up, wondering if the Timbrimi machine was being tactful or obliquely sarcastic.
"Well," she said, "what's done is done. Whatever happens can't affect us here. I just hope we don't add a crime against a sentient race to our dubious record on this voyage." She sighed. "Now will you tell me again how all this is going to become some sort of legend?"
Chapter 88, Toshio. The connection was made. Now Kredaki could listen to the underground sounds to his heart's content. Toshio let the monofilament drop into the mud. He emptied ballast, and the sled rose in a spiral toward the drill tree shaft. When he surfaced, Toshio knew at once that something had changed. The second sled, the one belonging to Tom Orley, had been dragged up the steep embankment and lay on the sward to the south of the pool. Wires dangled from an open section in the control panel. Charles Dart squatted by the water's edge. The chimp leaned forward with his finger to his lips. Toshio cut the motors and loosened the straps. He sat up and looked about the clearing, but saw only the waving forest fronds. Charlie said in a guttural whisper,
"I think Takata, Jim, and Metz are planning to take off soon, Toshio, with or without me."
Dart looked confused, as if dazed by the foolishness of the idea. Toshio kept his expression guarded.
"What makes you think that, Dr. Dart?"
"As soon as you went down, two of Takata Jim's stenos came to take that sled's radio. Also, when you were below, they tested the engines. They sounded kind of ragged at first, but they're working on them now. I think now they don't even care if you report back anymore."
Toshio heard a soft growling sound to the south, a low whine that rose and fell unevenly. A rustle of movement to the north caught his eye. He saw Ignacio Metz hurrying southward down the forest trail, carrying bundles of records. Behind him trooped four sturdy Kikwi volunteers from the village. Their air sacs were puffed up proudly, but they obviously did not like approaching the rough engine noises. They carried crude bundles in front of them. From the foliage, several dozen pairs of wide eyes watched the procession nervously. Toshio listened to the sound of the engines and wondered how much time was left. Takata Jim had finished recycling the bombs sooner than expected. Perhaps they had underestimated the Dolphin Lieutenant. How much else had he jury-rigged to make the longboat serviceable ahead of schedule? "Should I try to delay their takeoff? If I stay any longer, it's unlikely I'd ever reach Streaker in time."
"What about you, Dr. Dart? Are you ready to finish up and hop aboard when Takata Jim calls?"
Dart glanced to his console. He shook his head.
"I need another 6 hours," he grumbled. "Maybe we've got a common interest in delay in the longboat taking off. You got any ideas?"
Toshio considered. "Well, this is it, isn't it? This is where you decide. Leave now if you plan to go at all." Toshio exhaled deeply. "Ah, well. If I think of a way to delay them for a while, Dr. Dart, would you help me? It may be a little risky."
Dart shrugged.
"All I'm doing right now is waiting for my bot to dig into the crust to bury an instrument. I'm free until then. What do I have to do?"
Toshio unhooked the monofilament feeder coil from his sled and cut the free end. "Well, for starters, I think we'll need someone to climb some trees."
Charlie grimaced.
"Stereotypes," he muttered to himself. "All the time getting trapped by stereotypes."
Chapter 89. Jillian. She shook her head slowly. Maybe it was her tiredness, but she couldn't understand more than a fraction of the NIS machine's explanation. Every time she tried to get it to simplify some subtle point of galactic tradition, it insisted on bringing in examples that only muddied things further. She felt like a Cro-Magnon trying to understand the intrigues in the court of Louis XIV. The NIS seemed to be saying that Streaker's discoveries would have consequences that reached beyond the immediate crisis over the derelict fleet, but the subtleties eluded her.
"Dr. Baskin," the machine tried again. "Every epoch has its turning point. Sometimes it occurs on the battlefield. Sometimes it takes the form of a technological advance. On occasion, the pivotal event is philosophical and so obscure that the species in existence at the time are hardly aware that anything has changed before their worldview is turned topsy-turvy around them. But often, very often, these upheavals are preceded by a legend. I know of no other Anglic word to use for it. A story whose images will stand out in the minds of almost all savants. A true story of prodigious deeds and powerful archetypal symbols
which presages the change to come.
You're saying we may become one of these legends?
That is what I am saying.
Jillian could not remember ever feeling so small. She couldn't lift the weight of what the Nis was implying. Her duty to Earth and the lives of 150 friends and crewmates were burdens enough.
Archetype symbols, you say?
What could be more symbolic, Dr. Baskin, than Streaker and her discoveries? Just one, the derelict fleet, has turned the five galaxies upside down. Now add the fact that the discovery was made by the newest of all client races, whose patrons are wolflings, claiming no patrons at all. Here on Kithrup, where no presentient life was supposed to be able to arise, they find a ripe presentient race and take great risks to protect the innocents from a galactic civilization grown rigid and calcified. Now add the Korank. In all of the recent epics, no sapient race has been treated so foully, so abused by the system which was supposed to protect them. So what were the chances that this ship would happen to flee to the very planet that was their last refuge? Can you not see the overlying images, Dr. Baskin? From the progenitors down to the very newest race, what one sees is a powerful sermon about the uplift system. Whatever the outcome of your attempt to escape Kithrup, whether you succeed or fail, the stars cannot help but make a great song of your adventure. This song, I believe, will change more than you can imagine. The voice of Nis finished with a hushed, almost reverent tone. Its implication was left spinning in the silence. Jillian stood on the sloping ceiling of the dark, lopsided room, blinking in the sparkling light cast by the swirling motes. The silence hung. Finally, she shook her head. Another damned Dembrimi practical joke, she sighed. A goddamn shaggy dog story. You've been pulling my leg.
The motes spun silently for a long moment. Would it make you feel any better if I said I were, Dr. Baskin? And would it change what you have to do one bit if I said I weren't?
She shrugged. I guess not. At least you pulled me back from my own troubles for a little while. I feel a bit lightheaded from all that philosophical crap, and maybe even ready to get some sleep.
I am always ready to be of service, Jillian smirked.
Sure you are.
She climbed up on a packing crate to reach the door plate, but before opening the door, she looked back up at the machine.
Tell me one thing, Nis. Did you give Kredaki any of this bullshit you were feeding me just now?
Not in Anglic words, no, but we did cover most of the same themes.
And he believed you?
Yes, I believe he did. Frankly, I was a bit surprised. It was almost as if he had heard it all before, from another source.
That explained part of the mystery of the captain's disappearance then, and there was nothing that could be done about it now.
Assuming he did believe you, just what does Kredaki think he's going to accomplish out there?
The motes spun for a few seconds.
I suppose, Dr. Baskin, he is first off looking for allies on an entirely different level. I think he is out there trying to add a few choice stanzas to the legend.
Chapter 90, Kredaki. They moaned. They had always been in pain. For eons, life had hurt them.
Listen, he called out in the language of the ancient gods, coaxing the Korank to answer him. Listen, you deep hidden ones, you sad abused ones, I call from the outside. I crave an audience.
The doleful singing paused. He felt a hint of irritation. It came in both sound and sigh. A shrug to shake a bothersome flea away. The song of lamentation resumed. Kradiki kept at it, pushing, probing. He floated at the relay link Streaker had left behind, breathing from his sled's air dome, trying to get the attention of the ancient misanthropes, using the electrical buzz of a distant robot to amplify his faint message. I call from the outside, seeking aid. Your ancient tormentors are our enemies, too. That stretched the truth slightly, but not in essence. He hurried on, sculpting sound images as he felt their attention finally swing his way. We are your brothers. Will you help us? The growling drone suddenly erupted. The sigh portion felt angry and alien. The part that was sound grated like static. Without his apprenticeship in the Sea of Dreams, Kradiki felt certain he would have found it unfathomable. Do not bother us. Do not say. We have no brothers. We reject the universe. Go away. Kradiki's head rang with the powerful dismissal. Still, the potency of the sigh was encouraging. What Streaker's crew had needed all along was an ally, any ally. They had to have some help, at least a distraction, if Thomas Orley's clever plan of deception and disguise stood a chance of success. As alien and bitter as these underground creatures were, they had once been starfarers. Perhaps they would take some satisfaction in helping other victims of galactic civilization. He persisted. Look, listen. Your world is surrounded by gene meddlers. They seek us, and small ones who share this planet with you. They wish to warp us, as they did you. They will invade your private agony. He crafted a sonic image of great fleets of ships embellished with gaping jaws. He painted over them an impression of malicious intent. His picture was shattered by a thunderous response. We are not involved. Kradiki shook his head and concentrated. They may seek you out as well. They have no use for us. It is you they seek, not us. The reply dazed him. Kradiki only had strength for one more question. He tried to ask what the Korank would do if they were attacked. Before he finished, he was answered by a gnashing that could not be parsed even in the sense glyphs of the ancient gods. It was more a roar of defiance than anything decipherable. Then, in an instant, the sound and mental echoes cut off. He was left there, drifting with his head ringing from their anger. He had done his best. Now what? With nothing better to do, he closed his eyes and meditated. He clicked out sonar spirals and wove the echoes of the surrounding ridges into patterns. His disappointment subsided as he sensed Nukapai taking shape alongside him, her body a complex matting of his own sounds and those of the sea. She seemed to rub along his side, and Kradiki thought he could almost feel her. He felt a brief sexual thrill. Not nice people, she commented. Kradiki smiled sadly. No, not nice, but they hurt. I would not bother such hermits but for need. He sighed. The world song seems to say they will not help. Nukapai grinned at his pessimism. She changed tempo and whistled softly in an amused tone. Go below and hear tomorrow's weather. Go below. Prescience. Prescience. Kredaki concentrated to understand her. Why did she speak Trinary, a language almost as difficult for him now as Anglic? There was another speech, subtle and powerful, that they could share now. Why did she remind him of his disability? He shook his head, confused. Nukapai was a figment of his own mind, or, at least, she was limited to whatever sounds his own voice could create. So how was it she could talk in Trinary at all? There were mysteries still. The deeper he went, the more mysteries there seemed to be. Go below, deep night diver. Go below. Prescience. Prescience. He repeated the message to himself. Did she mean that something could be read from the future? That something inevitable was fated to bring the Karank out of their isolation? He was still trying to puzzle out the riddle when he heard the sound of engines. Kredaki listened for a few moments, but he didn't need to turn on the sled's hydrophones to recognize the pattern of those motors. Cautiously, tentatively, a tiny spacecraft nosed into the canyon. Sonar swept slowly from one end to another. A searchlight took in the scars in the seabed that the departing streaker had left behind. They scanned bits and pieces of abandoned equipment and finally came to rest on the little boxy relay and his sled. Kredaki blinked in the bright beam. He opened his jaws wide in a smile of greeting, but his voice froze. For the first time in several days, he felt bashful, unable to speak for fear of choking over even the simplest words and seeming a fool. The ship's speakers amplified a single, happy sigh, elegantly simple. Kredaki! With a warm pleasure, he recognized that voice. He turned on the sled's motors and cast loose from the relay. As he sped toward the skiff's opening hatch, he called out careful words in Anglic, one at a time. Hikahi, nice to hear your voice again. Chapter 91. Tom Orley. Fog swirled over the sea of weeds. That was good, up to a point. It made stealth easier, but it also made it hard to look for traps. Tom searched carefully as he crawled across the last stretch of weeds before the open end of the wrecked cruiser. This path couldn't be taken underwater, and he didn't doubt those who had taken shelter within the hulk had set up defenses. He found a device only a few meters from the gaping opening. Thin wires were strung from one small hump of vines to the next. Tom inspected the arrangement, then carefully dug below the tripwire and slithered underneath. When he was clear, he scrambled quietly to the edge of the floating ship and rested against the pitted hull. The weed beasties had taken cover during the fighting. They were out again, now that almost all of the combatants were dead. Their frog-like croaks refracted eerily in the noisome vapor. Distantly, Tom heard the rumble of the volcano. His empty stomach growled. It sounded loud enough to rouse the progenitors. He checked his weapon. The needler had only a few shots left. He had better be right about the number of Edies that had taken shelter aboard this vessel. I'd better be right about a number of things, he reminded himself. I've staked a lot on there being food here, as well as the information I need. He closed his eyes in brief meditation, then turned to crouch below the opening. He peeked one eye just past the ragged edge. Three bird-like gubru huddled around a motley array of equipment on the smoke-stained, canted deck. A tiny, inadequate heater held the attention of two who warmed slender-boned arms over it. The third sat before a battered portable console and squeaked in Galactic Four, a language popular among many avian species.
"No sign of humans or their clients," the creature peeped. "We have lost our deep search equipment, so we cannot be certain. But we find no sign of Earthlings. We cannot achieve anything more. Come for us."
The radio spluttered.
"Impossible to come out of hiding. Impossible to squander last resources at this time. You must maintain. You must lie low. You must wait."
"Wait! We shelter in a hull whose food supply is radioactive. We shelter in a hull whose equipment is ruined. Yet this hull we shelter in is the best still afloat. You must come for us."
Tom cursed silently at the news. "So much for eating." The radio operator maintained its protests. The other two gubru listened, shifting their weight impatiently. One of them stamped its clawed feet and turned around suddenly, as if to interrupt the radio operator. Its gaze swept past the gap in the hull. Before Tom could duck back, the creature's eyes went wide. It began to point.
"A human! Quickly!"
Tom shot it in the thorax. Without bothering to watch it fall, he dove through the opening and rolled behind a tilted console. He scuttled to the other end and snapped off two quick shots, just as a second standing gubru tried to fire. A thin flame spat out of a small handgun, searing the already scarred ceiling, as the alien shrieked and toppled backward. The Galactic at the radio stared at Tom. It glanced at the radio beside it.
"Don't even think it,"
Tom squawked in heavily accented Galactic Four. The alien's crest riffled in surprise. It lowered its hands and kept still. Tom rose carefully, never drawing bead away from the surviving gubru. "Drop your weapons belt and stand away from the transmitter. Slowly. Remember, we humans are wolflings. We are feral, carnivorous, and extremely fast. Do not make me eat you." He grinned his broadest grin to display a maximum of teeth. The creature shuddered and moved to obey. Tom reinforced obedience with a growl. Sometimes a reputation as a primitive had its uses. "All right," he said, as the alien moved to where he gestured by the gaping hole. Tom kept his gun trained and sat by the radio. The receiver gave out excited twitters. He recognized the model, thank Ifni, and switched it off. "Were you transmitting when your friend here spotted me?" he asked his captive. He wondered if the commander of the hidden gubru forces had heard the word human. The Galactic's comb fluttered. Its answer was so irrelevant that Tom momentarily wondered if he had totally misphrased the question.
"You must surrender pride," it chanted, puffing its feathers. "All young ones must surrender pride. Pride leads to error. Hubris leads to error. Only orthodoxy can save. We can save."
"That's enough," Tom snapped.
"Save you from heretics. Lead us to the returning progenitors. Lead us to the ancient masters. Lead us to the rule givers. Lead us to them. They expect to return to the paradise they decreed when they long ago departed. They expect paradise, and would be helpless before such as the Soro, or the Tandu, or the Thenanin, or..."
"Thenanin? That's what I want to know. Are the Thenanin still fighting? Are they powers in the battle?"
Tom swayed with the intensity of his need to know.
"Or the Dark Brothers? They will need protection until they are made to understand what terrible things are being done in their name. Orthodoxy's broken, heresy's abounding. Lead us to them. Help us cleanse the universe. Your rewards will be great, your modifications small, your indenture short. Stop it!
Tom felt the strain and exhaustion of the last few days rise in a boiling rage. Next to the Sorrow and Tendu, the Gubru had been among humanity's worst persecutors. He had had all he was about to take from this one.
Stop it and answer my questions!
He fired at the floor near the alien's feet. It hopped in surprise, wide-eyed. Tom fired twice more. The first time the Gubru danced away from a ricochet, the second time it winced as the needler misfired and jammed. The Galactic peered at him, then squawked joyfully. It spread its feathered arms wide and unsheathed long talons. For the first time it said something direct and intelligible.
Now you shall talk, impertinent, half-formed, masterless upstart! It charged, screaming.
Tom dove to one side as the shrieking avian screeched past him. Slowed by hunger and exhaustion, he couldn't prevent one razor-sharp claw from passing through his wetsuit and ripping his side along one rib. He gasped and stumbled against a blood-stained wall as the Gubru turned around to renew the attack. Neither of them even considered the handguns that lay on the floor. Depleted and slippery, the weapons weren't worth the gamble to stoop and retrieve them.
"Where are the dolphins?"
the Gubru squawked as it danced back and forth.
"Tell me, or I shall teach you respect for your elders the hard way."
Tom nodded. "Learn to swim, bird brain, and I'll take you to them." The Gubru's talons spread again. It shrieked and charged. Tom summoned his reserves. He leapt into the air and met the creature's throat with a savage kick. The shriek was cut off abruptly, and he felt its vertebrae snap as it went down, sliding along the damp deck to fetch up at the wall in a heap. Tom landed stumbling beside it. His eyes swam, breathing heavily with hands on his knees. He looked down at his enemy.
"I told you we were wolflings," he muttered.
When he could, he walked unsteadily to the ragged tear in the side of the ship and leaned on the curled and blackened lower edge, staring out at the drifting fog. All he had left were his mask, his fresh water still, his clothes, and, oh yes, the nearly worthless hand weapons of the Gubru. And the message bomb, of course, the weight pressed against his midriff. "I've put off a decision long enough," he decided. While the battle lasted, he could pretend he was searching for answers. Maybe he had been procrastinating, though.
"I want to be sure. I wanted to know the trick had a maximum chance of working. For that to happen, there had to be Thenanin. I met that scout. The Gubru mentioned Thenanin. Do I have to see their fleet to guess there are still some in the battle above?"
He realized there was another reason he had been putting the decision off.
"Once I set it off,
Quaidaki and Jillian are gone. There's no way they'll be able to stop for me. I was to get back to the ship on my own, if at all." While fighting on the weeds, he had kept hoping to find a working vessel, anything that could fly him home. But there were only wrecks. He sat down heavily with his back to the cool metal and drew out the message bomb.
"Do I set it off?"
The Seahorse was his plan. Why was he out here, far from Jillian and home, but to find out if it could work? Across the blood-smeared deck of the alien cruiser, his gaze fell on the Gubru radio. "You know," he told himself, "there is one more thing I can do, even if it means I'll be putting myself right in the middle of a bullseye,
At least it'll give Jill and the others all I know. And maybe it'll accomplish more than that. Tom summoned the strength to stand up one more time. Ah, well, he thought as he staggered to his feet. There's no food anyway. I might as well go out in style.